Episode 7. Well, enough about us. Let's talk about us for a minute. And we figure out how to ray trace, even if you don't have a computer.
Veterans and new media entrepreneurs, Sean Apple, PJ Foley, and Ephraim Patel.
Welcome back, loyal listeners. This is another episode of 10 Giant Robots. And this week, what are we talking about, folks? What are we doing?
Well, we're going to first, we don't really seem to have any old news. So we're going to kind of talking about the podcast, like metacasting.
Metacast. So skipping the old news right into metacasting.
So we're talking about us talking about talking.
Yes. Yeah. So right. That's how we do it.
It's like Escher-esque.
Yeah. We talk about talking.
So, yeah, I guess what our loyal listeners would not know is that we have not actually made a new podcast for 2 weeks, the past 2 weeks.
In fact, we haven't even launched the podcast yet.
That's right. So if you're listening to this, I don't know how you're listening to this.
Yeah. If you are one of the people who stumbled upon our website, you will have seen that it was 1 day and 6 hours remaining when it might have changed to 7 days.
That's time
12
travel.
Hours yeah. remaining and before those, it launches.
And the beauty is that time actually got added to the end of all of the listeners' lives. So yeah. we actually mm-hmm. improved your life.
You're welcome.
Jinx, you owe me a cold.
But what we're trying to do strategically is get a little stockpile of episodes so that we can dole them out at the appropriate speed and maybe give people a couple extra ones to get them hooked. Everyone knows the pilot episode of something might not be what the real show is, so right. we got to get that out there.
And by now you're fully hooked.
That's right, exactly. Oh, yeah. And you'll be happy to hear that we're now going to talk about cats. It's just entirely cats, so not yep. visual effects anymore, just cats.
Just cats.
Yeah, 10 giant robot cats.
And, attacking on.
But what has happened is a little bit of real life. Like a couple of our hosts here got sick recently. One of them started a new job.
Yeah, so we were actually going to talk about this.
Which leads right into it.
So I started a gig, and I told I have some relatives coming in town next week, and I said, I think everything's okay. I might have a gig. And she goes, what, do you play saxophone in a band?
Whoa.
But and I said, yes, do. I do, in fact. So,
no, you don't.
No, I don't. That's entirely not true. But so I took a gig, a short-ish term gig. It's about five or six weeks going to be.
And by gig, you mean visual effects.
Visual effects, sorry, yeah. Yeah, and in this case, it's motion graphics. So, that line is blurring anyway, because I'm doing visual effects for basically a really elaborate online site. Within 3 days, I was sick. And it's interesting, literally, I walked in the front door and sat down, guy next to me is hacking, and I'm like, oh, shit. And so I'm like, okay, and literally, like, this close. So I'm like, I will be sick in 2 days. And so, I did. I got sick, and it's some weird head, blood, doesn't matter. But
totally gross, though, I'm sure.
I know. It's like, disgusting. I know, this turned into, like, the senior podcast where we just talk about aches and pains, but... but the thing that was interesting about that is that, most jobs is like, you're like, I got a little thing. I'm going to stay home. It's like not visual effects, because you don't get gigs unless you're staff, people show up sick because they need the money. And I'm like, and you know what I did? I kept showing up.
Yeah. And perpetuate the problem.
Yeah, so you made the person next to you sick.
Well, the funny thing is, the guy on my right, I said, sorry for all the hacking, and I've been like trying to keep it to myself, been doing like vampire coughs into my armpit and stuff. And and I was like, he was like, told me his name, and I was like, sorry if I'm a little hacking stuff. I'm trying to keep it to myself. And he, the look on his face was like, Oh.
Oh, crap.
Which was my look when I walked. I was like,
now I've got that to look forward to.
Right. And usually I shake that stuff pretty quick, and like it's still hanging out. So I don't know what kind of
whatever,
doom and gloom.
You know, I got whatever you got, and I hadn't seen you.
Right.
Because we didn't do the podcast because you were sick. And then the following week, I had what sounds like the exact same thing.
It's just whatever, the summer crud or whatever.
Transmit it via email?
Or? Yeah.
Exactly.
So.
It's a virus.
It's that hip chat we use.
Yep. Right. It's not so hip.
Yep.
Yeah, well, this comes very topical, talking about this exact subject, because today is Labor Day.
Mm. And we're worked. Or not, we're working.
Yeah, and, the honest, strangest, like, this is, not to brag, but this is the first time in 8 or 9 years I've been paid for a day off.
That
and
is astonishing.
That's why I'm so like nervous. I'm like, it's going to go away any moment now because yes, I'm just not conditioned to
you've
it.
You've mentioned it. It's going away now.
Right. Yeah.
Nice one.
But luckily, this will happen after, I mean, or before. I don't know what the time is.
And yeah, plenty of time will pass.
Right.
We got lots of these episodes. And, but also, Obama was addressing the nation for his little Labor Day speech. And one of the things he was talking about was exactly what we're talking about, like a mandatory, lawmakers everywhere make a policy where people can take sick leave for themselves or for their family, get it on a national level. California, just in the last 2 months, something started at the beginning of the year, and we actually do have a way where it's a little bit dicey, but if you are a part-time employee, you can still get like 3 sick days a year. They accrue at a really ridiculous level. And for a VFX guy, unless your gig lasts more than 3 months, it's probably not going to ever kick in for you.
That's why every time I hear things like this, like new labor policies, I'm like, yep, doesn't apply to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Never does. Mm-hmm. Never does. Yeah.
Well, it's like, because you're never staff.
Right. Right. There's no,
Yeah. And it comes close because after 90 days, you get something like 6 hours. It's a really strange
and like
trade off,
but you still have to go in for 2 hours. Like, how does that work? You know,
but 90 days. So if, let's say I'm freelancing and I've been at this house for 90 days, then this law kicks in.
Yes.
So if they say somewhere within those 90 days, they say, you know what, take Thursday and Friday off, mm-hmm. but we're going to need you on Monday.
Yeah.
Then
potential loophole. Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's contiguous. It probably would be frowned upon if someone did try to get away with that.
Yeah,
sure. Well, get away with it. Good. I mean, gigs are like that. You know,
right.
What I mean? Like things that the work comes and goes, and they're like, we're done with this one. But you know what? We want to hire you again.
Exactly.
Yeah, like you come back and your job code changes on your paycheck or your payroll company changes. Everything.
I remember too. The one named, but company that we worked for, we already gave it away. But I remember they fired everybody or fired a chunk of people on Friday and hired them back as freelance on Monday.
So they were staff 1 week and freelance.
Literally,
next.
The weekend was the difference.
Huh.
Yep, Monday hire, Monday back as freelance.
Now that's good business.
No, it's not.
Well, 3D conversion houses did that repeatedly, and until they just made that bottom of the barrel, like just commodity style work. It's
right.
Ugh.
Yeah,
I mean, they were brutal.
Now, isn't that an opportunity for artists to renegotiate a higher rate, or are they just so desperate and shocked at that point that they'll take a lower rate?
So here's the problem, is that the renegotiating of a rate only works as a school of fish. Because if one person's deciding they're going to raise their rate and everybody else is going to keep or lower, the one fish goes away. Because it's a supply and demand issue.
You know? The skill level required for 3D conversion, a lot of it is just strictly roto, and they can get a lot of fresh kids out of school. Plus,
right.
they aren't just threatening to outsource, go overseas. They are doing it. So if you want to keep a job in the U.S., you got to compete with those prices.
Right.
It was pretty bad. Like, people were coming back from, okay, for L.A. pay, like, you know, respectable to $15 an hour or something like that. Way less than half.
You know what?
The rate.
I don't understand why you would take that job.
No,
like,
no,
I mean,
shouldn't.
Go work at Target or something. You know what I mean? Like, go someplace that's actually got benefits and stuff. Like,
well,
if
you think you're trying to build a career in the industry in VFX, like, that's why you stay.
But if you think about, I mean, what a beautiful reel you have of roto.
Yeah,
but you can say I worked on all these high profile 3D projects,
which is fine.
And sometimes
that whole thing is like,
well, sometimes it's just essentially working versus not. So you got to keep that in mind.
That's true. Yeah. And you can technically are in the business at that point.
And when you're starting out, if you can say like, hey, I worked on Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland.
Right.
You know, that's my first IMDb credit. Now I'm legit.
You know what's weird about that? Or maybe this is just my perception. And just being around forever is like, so. You know, and I don't mean so because it's not a cool project. I mean so because that only seems to work best at, maybe I'm wrong on this, but because I don't hire anybody. Maybe this does work if you're hiring somebody, but that only works for bragging rights at a bar. Because it's, you know what I mean? But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that does have an influence.
As a hiring guy, it just shows what kind of ringer you've been put through.
That's an interesting point.
You might get the backstory on certain projects. Like there's ones where you can't fault anybody who worked on that for the results because you just hear so much of the story of the management and the approach and conditions that people were working in. And sometimes you realize that, Alice in Wonderland was shot in a way that was going to be very difficult for 3D conversion. So anybody who powered through that and got it, good for them.
And there's you could say that it at least shows that someone else took a chance hiring this person.
And I think that's it. PJ is probably more qualified than definitely me to talk about this. But like I guess if you've been in the trenches, that's good. As opposed to I'm fresh out of school or whatever, you might get the person cheap, and then you might get a lot of energy and enthusiasm, but you won't get the experience and the the tricks and all that.
I mean, a reel still is important, I would imagine.
With 3D conversion, no.
No, but I mean just in hiring in general. Like if you've worked in 3D conversion but you have nothing to show, it's not as good as if someone worked in 3D conversion and still somehow has a reel of work, maybe stuff they've done on their own time.
Yeah. I would think ultimately, unless you want a life of roto, you're going to be working on your stuff on the side anyway, I would hope. Building.
Or your next step is to go to a house that does visual effects and intern.
Exactly.
Basically take the roto,
for 4 years.
The roto position where they abuse you.
Right.
And your enthusiasm for 4 years until you're jaded enough to say, you know what, I'm not doing this, I need to, whatever. And then you start to put your foot down.
Right. And then you realize I could have done that 3 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I think when you've spent enough time doing these jobs, my impression is that folks who do this work get to a point where they're just like, I'm not taking any more shit.
Right. Network. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Right. Like, yeah. I'm not, I don't care about the IMDb credits. You're going to pay me. Like, I'm doing, let's be clear, I'm doing this for money.
Right. Right.
I need to pay my rent. I need to whatever, pay my car payment. I'm not here for, because there are so many people who will try to sell you on a credit.
Which is worthless.
Or prestige.
Right.
Well, you know, you're doing this. This movie is being directed by you, so you want to be involved with that, right? So here, let me pay you nothing.
Right. Exactly.
Well, I usually just send those credits to the mortgage company, and they're cool.
Well, luckily, that will take that in lieu of payment.
Like, credit. That must
wow,
be
you worked on Alice in Wonderland?
And my favorite thing is, seeing if you got a credit. This happened with Battlestar on the miniseries. Worked on the miniseries, and remember watching it. And I was actually back in Indiana, and my parents were hanging out watching it with me. And it was like kind of the first thing they've seen that I've done. This kind of a big, which is weird. I'd been doing it for 1,000 years before then. So, but that hat, whatever, the stars aligned for that one. And watching it and kind of waiting for the credits, and they do that bullshit where they smash it over to the side.
Smash it and speed it up.
Right,
exactly. Yeah, and then like play some ad on the side or some promo for the next thing coming
there's
up.
There's four lines next to five lines. My name's 4 and 5 letters. That could be me.
Right, exactly.
Like, trust me, they listed me somewhere, Mom.
Right. Well, and I also had a weird thing. Speaking of credits, I had a weird thing where I was working on, what was I working on? I was working on Day After Tomorrow. Doing breath stuff, and they couldn't figure it out, whatever. There was a lot of going back and forth between me, another artist, and The Flame, and everybody was trying to find a way where it didn't look screened on, it actually looked real, And so that was a back and forth, and maybe I'm getting this has been a long time ago, but that one was, they ended up passing, I think, that off to Flame, so I lost that one. But then I got another one for Van Helsing, the Hugh Jackman thing. And ended up finishing that shot. So, but it was weird because the one that I actually did more work for, I didn't get a credit for. And the one that I was like, oh, can you do this real quick? Like, yeah, sure, okay. You know, like kind of until the next thing comes in, that's the one I got a credit for. So it's like, I never understood the credit process. Like, I don't know how or when or whatever you get a credit, but
yeah. And sometimes there's all kinds of, it depends what guilds and distributors and all that agreements that the studio has as to who gets a credit and what they could be called. Like, we've submitted credits for someone called a technical director, because that's what his title was on this thing, and they sit back, well, you can't call him a director.
Oh, that's right.
So, specialist or something like that. And then there's the VES has all the recommended credits, which is a ton of them.
Right.
There's a lot.
That reminds me of and maybe we're riffing a little bit, the interview that Tim Ferriss did of Robert Rodriguez.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about the credits. And Robert Rodriguez has been booted out of the Directors Guild 3 times or something like that.
Yeah, he's like, don't even try to get me back anymore.
Right, right. He doesn't want to be in it. They keep dragging him. They go, oh, come on, it's embarrassing. You're doing big movies. You're not in the Directors Guild. And he's like, because he just wants to make the movie. He doesn't care about all the credits and stuff. And one of his credits was, I think it was Dusk Till Dawn, was shot, chopped, and what was it? He just created like a hipster way of saying, I directed it, edited it, and wrote it, directed it, and edited it, whatever. And he did it sort of like shot, chopped, and dropped, whatever. It was right. Like kind of. And I guess that pissed him off because that didn't fit within a, you know, Directors Guild category.
And they
like,
booted him for that.
That I don't know if it was that specifically, but it's been a lot of back and forth because he's like, it's just dumb. And I think at some point it is dumb. And I understand the idea of protecting people. I get that. But like, it just gets silly after a while.
Anyway. Well,
and rant.
I can segue this.
Yeah, let's do it.
I can do it. So all Mr. Robert Rodriguez wants to do is make his art.
Yeah, that's right.
We were going to talk about.
Oh, well done, sir.
I don't know. Where's he going? What are you talking about?
We're
going
to talk about high art, the execution of art, the technical aspects of art, and frame it around a wonderful, awesome documentary called Tim's Vermeer.
Tim's Vermeer.
Which has a particular tie-in with visual
effects. There's
a very
geeky VFX-y tie-in with that.
So set it up. Set it up.
Okay, so
we just did work. Tim, what's Tim's last name?
I forgot.
Oh, but he's one of the creators of Lightwave. Or is he creator of Lightwave?
No, seriously. Why am I blanking on this?
It's not Vermeer.
It's not Tim Vermeer.
No.
I forgot his last name all of a sudden.
Well, she'll note it.
We'll give him a shout out next week. I think we mentioned him in a previous podcast.
Yeah,
we did bring up.
Do we set it up
before?
Okay.
Wow, this is so
bad. We're aging and have no memory.
I want to edit it out. It's so bad because he's a Facebook friend of mine.
No,
not anymore.
Tim, sorry. It's over.
Wow. So anyways.
Well, Tim, we'll get your last name in here. But so set up the doc.
So who is Tim?
That's just bad. Tim is a very successful businessman who started New Tech and is famous for the video toaster, which had a little piece of 3D software in it called Lightwave. And I can't find his name. And Lightwave, of course, became highly successful on its own and broke off into its own separate package. And meanwhile, the video toaster it's just mere, shades of it's what it used to be, but they've gone on to make other products called the TriCaster,
which is big for like mega churches and
yeah,
things
it's
like
got
for
its own yeah, and video podcasts, YouTube celebrities. It's a go to box that will do all this stuff. And
so he's a technical guy. He's a programmer, super smart guy.
Yeah, and he's been able to afford himself some luxury of pursuit to go down the mystery of Vermeer and how he was able to create art that seemed to be impossible for the techniques at the time.
Tim Jennison.
Jeez. There it is.
Wow.
There it is.
I'm so embarrassed.
Yes.
And I just remembered that off the top of my head because I'm a better friend.
And also, weirdly, did he just... He unfriended you. Aww.
Yeah, apparently. He's listening in real time.
Is it? This something that's on broadcast.
That's what you get for using a TriCaster.
Wow.
Exactly. Yeah. If we had used TriCaster, this thing would have been out already.
So, PJ, yeah. You had told me about Tim Vermeer some time ago, and it took me a long time to finally sit down and watch it. It sounded interesting, but I didn't really... I'm like, okay, so some guy, and I think I vaguely understood that he worked in visual effects, but I didn't know in what capacity. And he had some obsession with Vermeer. I'm like, okay, he wants to paint a Vermeer. I don't understand why. Mm. Maybe he's just an aspiring painter, and this is like his favorite paint artist, and he wants to see if he can replicate it. But no, it was much more than that. It was just sort of one man's obsession with how this painter from, I forget which century.
Would have been 17th century.
He's one of the Dutch masters.
Yep,
okay,
that's right.
Dutch master at a time when painting, realistic portraits and realistic paintings, basically getting the geography and the light as accurate as possible. Photorealism wasn't a term back then because there were no photos, obviously, but that was what they were going for. At that time, when that was becoming a real movement, he stood several heads above any other painter in terms of the accuracy of his paintings. They seemed to pop with a life that could not be explained. And when the paintings were examined in modern day via X-ray technology, which normally allows you to see the layers of paint and what's underneath on the canvas, normally you would find pencil marks that the painter, where he or she sketched out the and sort of planned the painting beforehand before they started putting paint on the canvas. And on Vermeer's paintings, with the exception of the very first one that he did, no pencil markings of any kind.
No planning,
just paint.
Right.
So the man apparently had the ability to walk up to the canvas, start laying down pigment, and ended up creating these photorealistic images that were just stunning.
Right. And it's also, too, that was sort of the arms race of art for a long time after the medieval period, which is where perspective was wrong and proportion was off and stuff like that. And you really saw a movement in the Renaissance period, and especially with the Dutch masters, to do photorealistic things. And you would still have people like Rembrandt that would shape the light so it had an impact, so you'd have sort of the brownish tobacco tints and stuff. But Vermeer was the first to really go for what you're actually seeing from a pigment standpoint. One of the things that I thought was really interesting about the process is two big things stuck out for me. First is you have optical aberrations in a painting. You would never have that. And one of those is, for example, if you have your phone and you notice sometimes you'll have the foreground's out of focus and the background's in focus, or vice versa, or something's in focus and something is not in focus. Your eye never sees that. By virtue of a person who would paint a picture naturally, your eye, wherever your eye is looking, is in focus. So you would never paint anything out of focus. It would never occur to you, because that's not how you actually perceive the world, you know? Although as I look at you guys, I can detect this is out of focus, but I would never, cause as soon as I look at it, it's in focus.
He's so, pointing at his microphone.
I am sorry. This is a visual. So that for me was fantastic. And then also getting bokeh, slight bokeh. You would never get bokeh if you were just visually looking at something. By the way, bokeh, if you're not familiar, is sort of the highlights bloom or get bigger. They look like bright dots on a photo.
Yeah, when they go out of focus,
that's right.
That shape becomes really evident.
That's right.
And I believe it mirrors the shape of the aperture
that's
of
right.
the camera.
And it's a telltale that there's glass and optics involved.
Now, the book that you have was a sort of a key starting point for the documentary, and I think it inspired Tim to go on this journey.
That's right. It's by David Hockney.
David Hockney. It's called Secret Knowledge.
And this this book, actually, we have it here. We'll put it in our show notes. But this book is the premise of this book is the idea of using optics that were available, glass lenses that were available of the time period, and essentially creating a light box of sorts where an image, and it could just be a whatever, it could be, you know, outside, it would project into the lens and then reproject into a dark room on a wall, almost like an overhead projector or like a video projector. And then the idea would be that you would trace that. And so that is the premise of the Hockney book, that Vermeer's paintings are actually photographs in a sense that it's being optically generated and essentially just traced.
So it's a live subject or live right. room that has a lot of light, and then there is a lens, presumably in a wall.
That's right.
And back then, they had the technology to make very fine lenses.
Right.
So this lens in a small hole in a wall, the light is filtering through that and projecting into a dark area. There's like a room within a room, essentially.
That's right.
And that's the camera obscura.
That's correct.
And so it would be upside down and backwards on the back wall.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or just upside down?
Just upside down,
just
probably.
Upside down.
Yeah.
So, and then it would be traced on a canvas,
right,
presumably, and then that traced image would be painted. But of course, we know that there was no pencil markings on Vermeer's canvases. So then it becomes a question, could he actually apply pigment to the canvas in this camera obscura?
And that's the... Jennison had a really interesting discovery on that.
Quick side note.
Yeah, yeah.
If you are in the LA area, you can experience a camera obscura down by the Santa Monica Pier.
No kidding.
Oh, that's right. That's what that building is.
I think you can get a key or permission, someone to open the door for you by finding a park ranger type person, and they'll let you in there.
That's right.
That's bizarre. Who? Why?
It's right by the... You've seen it. You've walked right by it.
Because it's... I think it was just sort of a 1920s sort of...
Yeah, Gatsby kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, okay. Just a miracle of the age, something to check out.
And it's down by the pier.
A marvel.
You have passed the building. You thought it's a bathroom.
And someone was painting me while
exactly.
I was waiting,
so
waiting in line for the bathroom.
If you go inside, it's creepily paintings of you.
Yeah.
It's this weird thing. It's like, it's not
this,
all about me. It's like, oh, it is all about me.
Yeah.
So this book and this concept that Vermeer had used a camera obscura to paint these photorealistic images, this is what set Tim on this path. He had some thrown around money and time to kind of explore whether or not this was possible. So he essentially built a camera obscura in a studio to see, can I do this? Is this even plausible? And one of the things he found is that, yes, you get an image projected on a canvas. It is somewhat dim.
Right.
And a little fuzzy around the edges where the glass is bent. But then when he started applying
pigment, right,
things started to get really strange.
Because white is not white. Because it is, by virtue of a projection, it's light being projected onto a background of some type, you know? So it's the idea, it's additive light. So you can't tell what you're painting, because if you have an image projected on a wall and you start painting what you think is that color, it's not that color because it's light's being projected onto that color.
And that's just ignoring the fact that your hand is going to totally block.
Right. Exactly. And that's a whole other issue.
A huge blob of the image.
So you have a shadow your own shadow you're competing with all
right.
the time.
And, yeah. and you can't really manage that except for sort of moving around. So let's say you get in the perfect position to paint a particular feature.
Right.
You cannot, it's nearly impossible to tell how the pigment you're putting down matches with the projected image, because the projected light is going to screw up your perception of the color anyway.
And the only way you could do a back and forth is you'd have to close the lens and open the wall to let daylight in enough to see what color the pigment actually is. And the practicality of that, I mean, now this is pre-computer age, so probably there's more time on people's hands, but that's almost undoable.
And then when you take into consideration how much fine detail there is in his paintings,
you would never get that. You would never have that resolution being projected.
Well,
you just wouldn't
have it.
It's so dim,
for one.
That's right.
You can't even get the contrast, probably,
and
right?
If you think even like the optics in this, I'm pointing at a video projector here, the optics in this far exceed what would have been available then, and I can't do it here. So it's like, it's still dim enough, you know.
But then someone could say, you know, looking at this could say, well, okay, so the guy just had a talent for looking at a space. He's got, you know, some objects in a room, some people in a room, and he's just really, really good at looking at that and doing a faithful rendition of that.
Which is entirely possible.
But one of the things, I think it was either this book, Secret Knowledge, or another book, where the author basically had done the research, jumping off the idea of the camera obscura, and assuming that Vermeer used the camera obscura, this author noted that all these paintings that Vermeer did seemed to be in the same studio space.
Right.
There were shared features, and it seemed to be...
There's always light from the left coming through a window. And,
right. So he's working in a space, a very controlled space. So he then went about and did sort of computer simulation, examining each of the paintings, kind of determining, like, okay, well, if this painting was done with a camera obscura, and the canvas, the actual canvas that he was using was this big. That means he had to have this much distance from the
lens.
That's
right. It becomes a math problem.
And he did the math to work out sort of the geometry of the room for that painting. And what he found was that when he did that for each painting, the math lined up from painting to painting.
Which I thought was brilliant.
Which is, yeah, that goes beyond the level of someone with talent to, you know, reproducing a room on a piece of canvas.
It means you're requiring a mechanical circumstance to create your images, where otherwise it would just be an easel. And your easel would rarely go in the same place, I would imagine, unless it's nailed down to the ground.
So what are the mechanics? What could he have used in that day and age to help him?
Well, I mean, geometry's been around forever, so he had that available to him.
Right, but painters had been using geometric techniques to work out perspective for quite some time.
Right. Oh, I was just talking about how to create the room. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying, like, the question that Tim was facing was, okay, there's no way... I mean, it doesn't make any rational sense that he could have painted with this level of accuracy from painting to painting.
Oh, exactly right.
So
exactly.
How could he have done this? What mechanism did he devise to allow him to paint with such amazing accuracy?
Right. And
should we
let PJ, are we going to leave it open here?
It's not the Polaroid camera?
It's not.
It turns out it is not. That didn't, the Land camera did not. Or what, do you want to give it up, or do you want to, should it be a teaser if people want to watch it, or?
Well,
the secret, the pudding?
Well, we can say, if you want to watch the documentary, this is a good time to maybe...
A spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert. This is like an exception. Usually we just go right into spoilers, but this one's very technical and intriguing for especially people like us who work on simulated optics all the time, ray tracing and all that kind of thing. So, skip forward or something. Quit now. No, but the technique is... I'm a little less fresh on the show, but because I watched this earlier, I don't know, several months ago. And to give yourself a basis of comparison, he was able to, I guess, mount a mirror over his painting surface.
Like a round dental mirror kind of.
Yeah, almost like that. Yeah. And he could just, by dodging his eyes to the left and to the right a little bit, he could see what he was painting just to the side of that mirror. And therefore, match the detail to whatever is the resolution of that screen, you know, that little tiny piece of mirror.
Right.
And more so, get the color rendition just right, because it's like taking two Pantone chips right next to each other until they match. He could just keep tweaking the color until it's there.
Yeah, and so essentially, he's got the canvas, he's seated at a desk, and the canvas is sitting in front of him, flat on the desk, and then... At the top of the canvas is the image that's being projected upside down. And then he's got the little mirror seated. It's basically halfway between his eye and the canvas, this little circular mirror. And he can see in that mirror, above the blank canvas, the image of the room projected. Now in the mirror, it's right side up, so it's correct to his eye. And so he can apply paint to the canvas and kind of shift back and forth to see how the image in the mirror matches up with the image on the canvas. And he knows immediately if he's got the right tone or not in any particular point on the canvas, because if he's got it correct, then the two tones disappear. Basically, the line between the mirror and the canvas will vanish to his eye, and he'll know he's got the right tone. And he can do the whole painting that way.
He becomes a meat-based ray tracer.
That's exactly right. You know, I looked at that technique. It's like a cousin to tracing or a cousin to onion skinning. You know, the old school onions where you'd flip three or four pages in your fingers. You know, because what you're doing is, and even people who draw, who just draw from photographs, you know, and there's a really great documentary about a forger on Netflix that the guy did that. He has a photograph right next to the thing, you know, to where he's drawing. He's constantly going back and forth. It is a constant eye comparison between what you're doing and what the object that you're drawing or painting is. And you probably do it, who knows, 150,000 times in a session or whatever, you know. The thing that I two things that came to mind. First of all, it would take a Tim Jennison to figure this out, and it would take a Tim Jennison to execute it, because the level of monotony and detail and just brute force it takes to generate a painting based on that is monumental. It took him over a year, if I remember right. Was it just shy of a year?
Well, they
to actually paint it.
I'm not sure. They paused the production or his production of the art in order to make the documentary.
It was a number of months. It was a number of months of actually
the execution,
actual sitting down and painting. But I just want to point out real quick one of the key differences, because you mentioned this is sort of akin to tracing or onion skinning. One of the key differences that is so brilliant about this technique is that tracing had been around, you know, back then, which,
right.
You know, why or at least creating pencil drawings to guide a painting,
right?
And what you're essentially doing is you're reducing an image that is light and shadow and hue and value into lines.
Into
outlines, which is really it's really a very different way of looking at forms, and it's very limiting. And to get what this technique allowed Vermeer to get was, instead of lines, he got light and shadow and color, and he was able to recreate that basically pixel for pixel. If you think of it in terms of pixels or paint blobs, he could get it accurate with each blob. Each stroke of the brush would be the right color, the right value, in the right place.
You know, that exercise is, I don't know if you've ever read Drawing on the Left Side of the Brain, or Right Side of the Brain, I forget what it is.
It's the right side.
It's the right side, okay.
Not the wrong side.
It's for those of us in the know.
Yeah.
It's the one on the left.
What is that? Callback. the concept that there's a fundamental difference between creating art that way and creating art from a drawing, in that drawing on the right side of the brain, the premise is one of the exercises, you flip a drawing upside down, because you are only looking at form. You're not trying to draw an eyeball. Does that make sense? You're trying to draw a shape. And the concept being that when you remove your ego, even in a positive way, what you think it looks like, and just draw what's in front of you, chances are you'll get a lot closer, because it's an abstraction that your brain can execute more accurately. Anyway, the idea being that if you're using a mirror like Tim Jennison did, it's an exercise. It's that kind of exercise. It's not a creative exercise. It's an exercise of diligence and just persistence, really.
And that book, I think, should be required viewing or reading for anyone who wants to learn how to see things for a living.
Absolutely.
Because it is a technical book. It doesn't seem like it, but it is. It's a very technical book. Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain.
Oh, it is, yeah.
Because it deconstructs how you can reproduce things in the real world as a drawing specifically.
Right.
But it helps you see things within your comps, within your own work to, like I said, take your ego out of it so you don't get... You don't get lost in what perception of something should be, but you get more accurate to how it should look physically.
And that's the thing, too. If you ever watched a matte painter, somebody who just does matte paintings, that's all they do, is they're always flipping it. Have you noticed that? And upside down. Because your eye is seeing things that you're not... You're making assumptions that may be inaccurate. And when you flip the painting, a mirror image of the painting, you'll see stuff that you wouldn't see in the normal thing.
Oh, I'll never forget when I was a kid, because I used to draw a lot as a kid, and I'd draw people and... One of the things I used to like to do is, I was a big fan of Mad Magazine, and in particular, Mort Drucker, the artist. Big fan. That was the first time I really honed in on an artist, and I loved his style drawing, and I used to take his... He'd have these big two-page layouts that were very complex, and I, for some reason, I got the idea that I want to copy that.
That's big.
Yeah.
And how old were you?
I don't know, 8, 9, 10, okay. Like that. Those ages. And I did a number of them just for, I don't know why. I think maybe it's a little OCD. I like to sit there and just really work on something for a long time. But
there's a zen in that too.
There's a zen in it. And I didn't expect this, but I actually learned a lot about drawing different things. Like, you know, people complain that they can't draw hands. And I never studied hands, but I drew enough of Mort Drucker's drawing of hands that I kind of got sort of like, I got enough techniques. They just sort of filtered in that I don't have a problem drawing hands now.
And this might be, I don't want to divert us too far, but that's an interesting concept too of how to learn art, is there's two approaches. There's the technical approach, and then there's studying anatomy, and da da da, and you know, and then there's the just draw what you enjoy, and you will absorb the technique, and that is actually a more motivated way because you have skin in the game,
and you can always add those other elements. You can always study anatomy, and you can study theory and all those things. But yeah, as a kid, those I didn't want to do anything that was academic. As a kid, in regards to art, I just wanted to do what I enjoyed.
Well,
but when I would have a drawing, I had a drawing of somebody that I really liked, and I'm like, oh, this turned out really well. And then I saw it in a mirror.
Oh,
and that was or I picked it up and I saw it, you know, the light shone through it, and I'm like, oh, it looks effed up.
Yeah.
Backwards, like it was slanted, or you know, something was really off, and I'm like, I've got to check my work.
And you know, that to me is there's a lesson in there, and I think the lesson is not just that it's fucked up or whatever. You know, I think it's also the idea that when you are so close to something, you lose an objectivity. And I think that's why it's important to, no matter how good you think your art is, whatever it is you're creating, whether it's writing or drawing or whatever, a movie, whatever it is you're making, it's always important to get feedback from people that you trust, that you feel like have, you know, first of all, are on your side. They're not, you know, and then also, too, you feel like they kind of have an understanding of what it is you're trying to do. Because at some point, you just stop seeing it, you know, and it's not an ego thing. It's just your brain has this great facility of compensating, you know, and you don't know that you're doing it, you know, and that's the great mirror experiment is like, oh shit.
Yeah, if you're making a film, you kind of need to see it in the mirror, which makes me actually, I know that's sort of not what you're saying, but I'm actually wondering in this moment, like, what would it be like to take a film that I'm working on and like actually play it for myself in a mirror reverse? Like,
madness, because are you really going to do the whole movie again if it's not?
No. But it might affect some choices in editing or whatever. You might be like, oh, you know what? Or maybe something as simple as I'd like to push in like 5% on that particular
all your
frame
protagonist and antagonist change roles.
Right. Exactly. Suddenly I'm like rooting for the wrong person.
Two things on that. First of all, I had heard a long time ago, and I don't know if this is a Snope or what it is, but I had heard that the camera favors people that are symmetrical, their faces are symmetrical, so you can flop them, you know, or flip them in.
What?
And then there's also, this is a complete aside, but there is a really cheesy movie from the 60s, I think, where these two astronauts go on the other side of the moon. It's like one of those 50s things, you know, and then when they slingshot back, they come back to the inverted version of, and all it is they just shot it and just flip the negative. It's hilarious, but it's like, it's pretty fun because you're
so they're confused because like writing is backwards or what?
I don't know if they got into that. Like, it didn't maintain my attention for long, but the premise is a great 60s, like, special. Hey, you know what? Yeah, and also like a
astronauts can, back from the moon.
Well, I can just hear the pitch. It's like, you know, Arkoff or whatever that guy's name is, like, hey, here's what we'll do. We'll just shoot half the movie and we'll flip it, right? You hear me? You know. One thing I wanted to say that I thought Tim Jennison's Smoking Gun, where I believe he has found it, was the detail on the virginal, I guess is what they call it, the harpsichord. There is really ornate scroll work of the Vermeer images that he's trying to copy. And so as just an exercise to lay down lines as he's painting, there are certain parts of the virginal that he could take a straight edge and just draw a line. And so he did. And so he's just sort of blocking out the shape of the virginal. And when he starts painting, because he's doing this pixel by pixel, let's say, it's not really, it's paint, but he's doing it, you know, detail by detail. And what he discovers is the virginal's ornamentation is warped, but the line marking where the virginal is not. And he was like,
but not in real life. You mean on the canvas?
Right. And he made that mistake. He's like, oh crap. He's like, I can't do that because I made a straight line where there shouldn't be a straight line. So he was not doing the exercise. He was trying to cut. He was trying to, you know, cut a corner. And so he thought, oh, I'm going to screw it up. But then it occurred to him, I'm going to go look at Vermeer's original. Vermeer's original had the same error.
Right. And we should just say that error was, he realized immediately, was created by a slightly concave mirror that he was using because the camera obscura projection wasn't bright enough. Like, it wasn't bright enough, one, and two, the sort of fuzzy aberration around the size of the lens we're creating. He's like, there's no way I can get the level of detail like on the scroll work or whatever. It's not in line with what I was seeing in the actual painting, because he went and saw the original painting in Buckingham Palace. And he was like, wow, the detail. So the last, I think, aha moment that he had was, well, Vermeer could have used mirrors, and so let me try projecting into a mirror instead of onto the wall. And he found that if he had this mirror slightly concave to capture more light, he suddenly had, like, it was like 50 times brighter. All the detail was preserved. It was amazing. He finally was like, oh, I can do this now.
Right.
And that's how he started his painting. So when he got to that scroll work and he was about halfway through it and he'd already put down the straight lines, that's when he started to realize it's curving. The whole pattern is very slightly curved because of the curvature of the mirror.
An optical aberration.
Right.
And when I laughed out loud, I was like, you got it, old boy, you got it.
And he picked up Vermeer's painting and he looked at it like he held it perpendicular to his face so he could see right down the edge of the canvas, and he could see that the straight lines are straight and there was a slight curvature to that pattern on the music box.
So he discovered it eventually. I mean, I think the smoking gun was Vermeer made the same mistake he did.
Yeah.
And like, and not only that, what a cool thing, you Vermeer. Like, you're like, I just made the same. Vermeer and I have that in common. Who? Nobody else on the planet except for Tim Jennison and Vermeer have that experience.
And
in
you
common.
Know, if Vermeer did come up with, and I'm totally a believer that this is what Vermeer did after watching the documentary or something very similar to this. He would have kept that secret buried.
Oh, because that was the intention. They weren't even talking about, they couldn't even Sherlock Holmes it. He left no notes.
Because I mean, and of course, because that would be his special sauce. Like,
that's
at a time like that, if that got out, first of all, he wouldn't have been a magician anymore. All of his, what made him special, would be gone. And also, other painters would be able to replicate the exact same thing.
And that boils down to this. Boils down to money.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's his competitive advantage. You know, it's like, I can get it perfect. You know, it's like, and then you're going to get all the wealthy aristocrats and the noble people, you're going to get all their
clients. And no one will ever know how I did it.
That's right.
And by the way, so something else that's really, really interesting about the documentary is that Tim, in order to do this, in order to basically reproduce a Vermeer painting himself, and he's not a painter. He made that very clear early on. He's like, I don't know how to paint. I've never painted, but I'm going to paint a Vermeer using this technique to prove that this is how he could have done it and that a schlub like me who doesn't know how to paint could do it. So in order to do that, he needed to have a room that was set up as closely to reproducing what was in Vermeer's studio as possible. So he picked one of Vermeer's paintings that showed off his studio, showed off the windows where the light was coming in and all this stuff. And he's like, okay, I can, using what's in this painting, I can figure out the geography of the room, and we're just going to reproduce it. We're going to get the fabrics. We're going to recreate that stained glass window.
To me was crazy. It was like, wow, I don't know that you need to do all that.
He had some stuff custom built, and what he couldn't have custom built, he custom made himself. He learned how to do woodworking, and he hand created the lenses the way they would have had to. Yeah. He handcrafted the pigments.
It's something
for the paintings.
See.
Can I throw something in here real quick? Because that has a spirit of I can figure it outness that is, to tie this back to visual effects, that's what makes a good visual effects artist. Is like you say yes before you know you can really figure out how to do it. And for me, the real joy is in figuring out how to do it, you know, and in the case of Jennison, the lathe was too short, so we cut the lathe in half and lengthened the. I mean, like the idea, like I can't do this, never crossed his mind because his brain works in a way that is it's just a puzzle. It's not more complicated than it's a puzzle, you know. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No,
it just
no,
struck me. It's like that's a very technical brain visual effects kind of
mentality. But it's wonderful to watch someone who has that attitude. It's just a puzzle.
Right.
I can work this out. And who also has the time, the determination, and the resources see it through. Because he really does see it through. And my heart went out to him after a while because he was so mired in the details, whether it be, you know, rebuilding the room or the actual painting itself, which took him months and months of sitting there in a room by himself, just putting blobs, tiny little blobs on a canvas. And I'm like, I so relate to to what you're going through right now, because I feel like I'm doing a short film right now, and I feel like I'm building it pixel by pixel.
Gosh, yeah. Right?
You know, it really, and you know, at some point, about halfway through, he was doing, you know, the knots on the rug, which were just these little bumps, and he had been doing hundreds of them, and the camera guy asked him, was like, would you be doing this right now if we weren't making a film? He's like, if we weren't making a film, I would find something else to do with my day. Honestly, exactly. I don't want to do this anymore.
He was committed. He was committed.
And when he finally unveiled the painting, he, you know, for the camera, he was talking and just, he couldn't help it. He just started crying.
You know, that's such a great cathartic moment, because for a number of reasons. First of all, he figured out a pretty great mystery.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is, like, you spend that much time with anything, and when you're done, you're going to fucking cry, man, because you're like, thank God.
And the third
God,
thing is, over. He created a Vermeer.
That's exactly right.
By
and
hand.
It looks like exactly like a Vermeer.
He didn't,
technique and all.
It's not like he sat with a Vermeer and copied it.
Right.
Certainly many people have done things like that. He created a Vermeer the way Vermeer would have created
that's
it.
That's right.
With a room, people standing in it, and I'm going to paint this.
You know, you were talking about a little something that I kind of wanted to see if you guys were interested in talking about. But there was a scene where they're at David Hockney's studio. He's a British painter, and he's somewhere in England. They go to visit him. And that's also the fun thing about the documentary. They go a bunch of different places around the world to kind of do research. But David Hockney wrote this book, and so he wanted to kind of run it by. David Hockney's a modern master who's a contemporary art, you know, painter and stuff, very well known. And wanted to get Hockney's response to that. And Hockney, when he finally brought the Vermeer, Hockney was in his wheelchair, scooting in and out and in and out, looking at it, and had this shit-eating grin. He's like, you did it. But I believe it was that scene. Tim had a great point. And he said, I'm a technician, essentially. I didn't choose the composition. I didn't figure out the lighting. I didn't figure out the textures. I didn't do... So the creative part of it, let's call it, the invention part of it, the compositional way, he took no credit for. And I thought that was fantastic, because he understands the difference between a technique and a piece of art. And I was curious if you guys want to talk about that for a minute, because I thought that was a nice theme in there of, like, this, and it's been running through my mind ever since I started being creative, is like, you know, the difference between being really technically good versus having something to say, you know. And I think those are two things, and I think one helps the other. I think the better you are at your technique, the better your ability to communicate what's kind of, you know, what your idea is, you know.
Well, that was one of the things that was mentioned in the documentary, is that there seems to be a fair amount of pushback in the art world. The idea that Vermeer, who's revered as one of the, you know, the masters who stood the test of time, that there was some technical aspect to his paintings. You know, trying to uncover what that was somehow takes something away from him being an artist. And I think, you know, what Tim was discovering and what he was sort of arguing throughout the course of this was that, why do they have to be separate things? Why does, you know, being a technician and a visual technician and an artist, why are they mutually exclusive?
They're never separate. Now, I don't know, if you want to be a good guitar player, you put in the hours. You're doing scales. You know what I mean? Like, that's technical. That's
right.
Not creative, you know? And I think that's just part of the experience, you know? And I think, too, that has been that whole problem, let's call it, of when is it art? You know, if it doesn't require a lot of skill, can it still technically be art? And that pushback has been around for years in the fine art world, like Jackson Pollock's and stuff, like, well, that my kid could do that kind of mentality. It's like, your kid could, but with the same intention.
Which I think is another documentary.
It is. It absolutely is.
My kid can paint that.
Yeah, it's great. Like, it's great. But I just think that's an interesting concept, especially when visual effects, when it's such a technical art form, you know.
Well, in a lot of movies, there are huge swaths of a major motion picture where the director, the cinematographer aren't directly involved, where they're not on set, they're not choosing lenses, they're not out there choosing composition, and when all the stuff is being laid at the feet of the visual effects department. And yes, it's enormously technical. All these things are like, how, not only what are we going to do, but how are we going to do it? Like the question of how did Vermeer do these things? It's very technical. There's a lot of very technical aspects to visual effects. But it's easy to forget that there's a tremendous amount of artistry there as well.
And when it's not there, it's the experiences, and we've talked about on our podcast, the experience is dull.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how well executed, all the technical gadgets and inventions and, you know, SIGGRAPH papers that you threw at something, if the intention blows, you're going to be bored.
Yeah, right.
I suppose one potential place where this gets foggy or something that you probably need to remind yourself about is, and I've even been very cynical about this very thing, is like you're really trying to execute someone else's vision.
Yeah.
And you're doing it at a very technical level. So you are, I would always say, we're image technicians, not artists. But a lot of other people are coming to the table to make that film who you would absolutely group in the artist side of things, the costume designer, the actors themselves, the DP, all those things. The editor, there's skill and finesse to that it comes only with taste and experience, you know, and some people, it's different. Everyone has a style. So it's important to remind yourself that, yes, you really are an artist.
You are. And there are people, you know, different levels of technicality involved in different jobs on set. And, you know, there's almost this idea that if something can be done in real time, then it's artistry. But you know what I mean? If you can act in real time, or if you can,
oh, that's
you
an
know,
interesting.
You can, you can pick out a prop, or you can pick out a, you know, we need this. You know, okay, we'll try on this jacket. You know, and it's in real time and it's happening. But if you have to go away and you have to stitch a jacket, or you have to, you know, you're building chain link one link at a time. You know, I'm not quite sure where I'm getting at with this, but
if I can riff off of that, the idea that when you have a creative impulse, the faster you can execute it, the sooner you can see if it works or not. And unfortunately, technical things, it takes a while to get to that impulse to see if it works or not. And that is a dangerous chasm, because, you know, the director could eat a sandwich between that, and the blood sugar could be different by the time they saw it begin. You know what I mean? So like the idea of like, when is it done, or when is it art, or when does it fit the piece, is so negotiable, you know, that, and changes and morphs. And that goes back a little bit to the problem of showing so many iterations to a director that they know they are no longer objective. And so that the whole bullshit about I'll know it when I see it. No, you won't, because you've already seen it 25 times. They don't understand that their opinion is morphing in real time. You know, it's not like a fixed thing that you know when you know, because it. And I think that's why it's important to sort of know in the music when the music's working, and to not and just be like, I got it. That's the music. And then, you know, if you can button it up and clean it up and polish it a little bit, that's great. So it's a little more finesse. That's fantastic. But know when the music is working. Know when the audience is, you know, dancing.
Right.
And then, but, and you're done after
but
that.
What I mean, okay, I'm just going to speak, take it out of the realm of doing work for someone else, because right now I'm doing a lot of visual effects work on my own.
Exactly.
Film, right?
Different experience entirely.
Different experience, but also at the same time, I'm working with other people who are working on that same film, right?
So you're on the other side
of
that.
I'm on both sides right now. And yes, when you're in the moment and you're listening to the music, like if you know what it is that you're going for, you'll know it. In a sense, you'll know it when you hear it, because you know
it fits.
Like you may not be able to hum the tune, right? Because you're not maybe a musician, but when you hear the music and you're like, yes, that works. Yes, that's, let's tweak this little thing. But if you're doing it, like oftentimes right now I'm in the animation phase of this short. So there's a lot of short shots that are being animated out of order. And I'm plugging those shots in different iterations into the edit and seeing how they work together. So it's a bit like, here's three notes of a song. Does it work?
And that goes back. That is the inherent difficulty of what it is that we do, because you can't just go monster.
Yeah.
You can't just go and it walks, and then it throws the thing over, and then the guy, and then, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
you can't do that. And I, one of the things that I'm excited about is the where OpenGL is going, or whatever DirectX, wherever we are. But the whole idea of video cards driving things, because the potential of, and then it run, you know, the it runs or it does the thing, or like you can at least you can it's, for me it's the equivalent of you may not have an orchestra, but you sure as hell have an acoustic guitar, and you sit down and go through the chords until you find chord shapes that you like, and you're like, yeah, that's the tune. And I feel like OpenGL may not be the final piece, but you can write the song faster and get an idea of where those beats are, and get an idea, which is sort of the idea behind animatics and things like that.
Right.
The idea is to try to get the movement and the feeling and the storytelling in there.
Well, I think when it comes to like character animation, you know, which is what I'm dealing with right now. I'm dealing with, you know, performances in different iterations, starting from no movement to blocking in movement to getting timing to getting, and it's not like, it'd be one thing if we were blocking in an entire performance, like this whole sequence, this and this and this and this, these things all happen in sequence, and now we're just going to act with the actors and get it down, and then when it's done, we'll chop it up. It doesn't really work that way. It's already has to be chopped up because
it's pre-edited. You're cutting in
camera.
There's
an edit, and there are camera tracks for each thing, and there are camera angles. So you have to make sure that the performance works within the camera angle as well, so you don't have just carte blanche to do whatever and then plug it into each shot. You have to design each bit of performance for per each shot. So what do you do? Do you go away and do you animate the character doing this whole sequence and then chop it up and then try to retrofit it into the shot? Or do you do each little piece separately? I think, you know, there are certainly tools for the larger houses and for the larger productions where they're motion capturing everything. Like I saw a bit recently about Jurassic World, where a lot of the dinosaur behavior was motion captured, which you wouldn't think because humans can't stand like raptors, or they can't move like those different things. But what they found was there is so much complexity in motion capturing body movements that you can retarget that to this character. And even if a lot of animation still needs to be done, you get so much for free.
That's right.
That just reads natural and reads alive that would be virtually impossible to hand keyframe, you know, into a creature.
You know, when you think about the idea of shooting just shooting live action, you're shooting a master, let's say, and you're shooting three people at a table playing poker, let's say, and let's say it's three camera shoot and you have a camera on each actor, so you really can capture the entire moment, you know, and maybe you have a fourth that's doing the master, whatever. So there's two ways of thinking about this. So there's the Spielberg way of thinking, which is not the master. And then there's sort of the standard, you know, you're creating a bunch of footage for a hired editor to go and find the movie, basically. The thing about a complete performance is that you can find moments, organic moments. Whereas if you are having to custom generate a moment, it is by virtue of that, it's not fixed because you can change it and find the space and find the movement. But the idea of, let's just say it's a matter of you don't have nearly the amount of opportunities to find the performance, you know, because you're having to generate it. So the process of discovery is, while it's still there, it's not as prominent as just watching a performance and going, oh, they looked at their watch just now. That's a great moment. Like that's a great reaction to that other character saying this and that and the other.
It's a bit like carving a performance into stone. You know what I mean? Like you have to just like every little stroke, like chip, chip, chip. Or maybe a more accurate analogy would be sculpting it into clay. Because yeah, you can change it, but it's not easy.
Right. Are you talking about
animating a performance.
Oh, right.
One little bit at a time, or even if you were able to do the whole sequence. Forget motion capture if you're just keyframing from zero, you know, trying to create a performance.
Right.
Those little happy things, those happy accidents, there's really no space for that to happen.
And I would love to see a space in CG where we can get to that, because I think something happens in the unconsciousness that gets out. And I think that's what you'll get in a live mocap performance, even if you're doing it for a raptor. You'll get a thing, you know, you'll get a movement, you'll get something that feels, there's something there's some underlying subtext going on, and that's very hard to indicate with CG.
They even had specific actors for the different dinosaurs.
I'm not surprised.
And each when one they had to do, when they had to do new motion capture, they'd be like, "Oh, okay, we're gonna get those same actors in to do each dinosaur."
So here's the other thing with like at least as far as I understand the Spielberg process. So it's my understanding that Steven Spielberg shoots in his head. So like he doesn't do the big masters and the big coverage. And they say when you sit down to edit a Spielberg movie, it's pretty much cut. You know, because he's and where I'm going with that is because he is seeing the ballet, not necessarily in the performances. He's seeing the ballet between the shots. And so for him, that is the dance. The edit is the dance. That's kind of a high level of creativity because you're having to, first of all, you're having to manage the set, get good performances, get everything out of all your artisans, you know. But then you're also cutting the movie in real time in your head.
Well, one of the things that can happen when you're doing that, when you have a sort of cut in mind, right, and you're shooting for this specific cut, is you can get very much into I'm creating puzzle pieces.
That's right.
And for this puzzle piece, I just need this. And for this puzzle piece, I need this. Now, that can sometimes not be really conducive to...
It can backfire on you.
It can feel very much like, you know, if these things don't match or whatever, if the performances don't align, or you get so laser focused on getting this one piece that you lose the flow of the overall... You know what I mean? Like, you don't get that... One of the great things about shooting a master is your actors and everyone gets into the rhythm of the scene. There's the chance for the happy accidents and for the organic discoveries.
But cutting back, I mean, how often are you going to cut back to the master, you know, to catch that stuff?
You may not, but what you do if you shoot the master first is that you find those things. It's almost like a shooting rehearsal. And so then when you go in for your specific shots, those things are already, you know, everyone's already sort of said, yeah, we like that. Let's do that thing with the watch and the drink and we'll have that pause. And so it takes on a life. But I saw an interesting thing on No Film School not too long ago about Spielberg's love of the and skill with the moving master.
Oh, that's a great piece.
I've seen it.
Have you seen it, PJ?
Mm-hmm. Where essentially he
on the boat on Jaws, the boat.
Movies where he has all these different what would typically be different shots and coverage, whether it be, you know, the master, the two shot, the close up, and all these things, and he's editing in his head, but he's not relying on the edits. He's actually creating a moving fluid camera, so it's all one shot, and you're getting all of those.
You're getting your masters and your close-ups
angles in one shot.
And the other thing too, that's it's also good from a standpoint, from an actor standpoint, because you get to have the entire scene. You're not constantly being stopped and started. So as an actor, you can get into the scene. You know, you can perform it like you would a play. And so you're going to get more naturalistic performances that way, and you're also going to get a lot more cool accidents and little things that happen and stuff like that.
I'll just say real quick, coming from the independent world, you know, as much as all of this makes perfect sense, the reality of shooting independent films, at least in the past, has been that you don't have the luxury of doing that.
Right.
More
often, that takes setup and blocking, and
it takes full control of the entire area. So you've got everything on a lockdown. Everything's lit. And so you can shoot any which way, and it's all perfect. And then, you know, it becomes this ballet performance that you're involved in. So with independent productions, you know, you might have a location for a very small amount of time, and you can really only shoot in certain directions because you've got limited lights. And there are a lot of constraints.
And the other thing, too, is if you're doing a big master where you're pushing in for mediums and close-ups, and that's all one fluid move, if you screw it up, you got to keep doing it until you get it.
Yeah, that takes time. It's the more things like that, like, okay, we're going to push in, or we're going to do any kind of camera move, or, you know, where there are more things that have to work in a single shot, in a single take.
Right. It's more plates.
Very likely you're going to do a lot more takes of that shot. Now, Spielberg's working with the top people in the industry. So
top.
So they may get there quicker, but still, the fact is they're going to need to do more takes. So that's more time. That means more money, and those are all the things that you don't have when you're shooting an independent film.
But that kind of goes back a little bit to you're right. I think locations are always tricky, and this is where I think you have a real advantage if you're in other parts of the country. L.A. Everybody knows you can get money out of it, so it's permit city and all that stuff. But if you're stealing shots, although you can steal shots here too, but if you're stealing shots or just getting shots or getting permission in other places in the country that are not so savvy to that, you might actually get the location for a chunk of time.
You might, but stealing shots is definitely runs afoul of the idea of having everything on lockdown.
Oh yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a run and gun mentality. You're not going to be able to rehearse a thing.
And then you might be shooting something without a lot of cuts because you're just like walking down the street with someone and as they go into a business or whatever.
Exactly.
Like, you know, it's not pretty.
And robbing the business.
And robbing the business.
And you got to get out of there fast.
You got to run.
Yeah, and you got to find your
driver. You got 15 seconds before they get there.
You know, there was one other thing I was going to say. It doesn't matter. I forgot.
It really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It just doesn't matter.
We should take our halfway break now that we're at
Is
the
it
end.
Only halfway?
No, we're way beyond.
Oh, we've done it. We've done another one. Oh, God.
Now you've done it.
Yeah, and it's a pretty hot day here in LA.
It is. Whew. And, you know, we had also had queued up a discussion about the Kingsman.
Well, that can be our next one.
We'll cue that up for next week.
Right, and stuff.
Yeah.
A little preview of coming attractions.
Chung, chung, chung.
Well, thanks for listening to another episode of 10 Giant Robots.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Have a great one.
10 Giant Robots is created and distributed by the 10 Giant Robots Radio Network in beautiful downtown Burbank, California. Our theme music was created by the incredibly talented Shane Knight. Follow us on Twitter at 10 Giant Robots or at 10giantrobots.com.